This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the introduction. And thank you for the pleasure of your presence and for the privilege that I can speak tonight to you about a very difficult subject. And please, if you don't agree with my opinions, then remember, don't bite my finger, look where I'm pointing. So the evening will be a little bit difficult because we have some mathematical expressions like rewriting program. I will not explain them from the beginning. I will explain it a little bit later. But I show you first what is the starting point. The starting point is a famous question by Duchamp from Philadelphia. The Slot Foundation is in Philadelphia, where we have this great Duchamp collection by the family Arensberg. And in election 1961, Marcel Duchamp asks, where do we go from here? At the end of the lecture, he said, on the fringe of a world blinded by economic fireworks, the great artists of tomorrow will go underground. This is precisely the situation today. That people are blinded by economic fireworks, losing milliards and billions. But I think the end of Duchamp, the great artists of tomorrow will go underground, will not function anymore, because there is no exit to the underground anymore. Even the underground, as we know from the 60s and 70s, was appropriated and was became part of the art system. So therefore the question is even more difficult. Where do we go from here, when the art world is blinded by economic fireworks? And I think what is always important to remember, when an artist like Duchamp, who was in the first part of 20th century, no art historical book. You can not find one single art historical book where the first 50 years of 20th century was mentioned. He was in the first 50 years of 20th century, he was a minor artist. Nothing compared with Picasso. Only after Neo-Dada, after Neo-Avant-Garde, only after Popart, he was rediscovered as a major artist and was the most influential artist in the second half of 20th century. But I think what is important, we should take him serious, even in the comments which do not please. It's not correct that we say Duchamp is a great artist, but when he makes comments which are critical of the art system, the same as his artworks have been critical, it's not fair to say we follow him when he makes critical art objects, but we do not follow him when he makes critical observations about art system. Because 1952, more than half a century ago, he made another statement. Artists of all time are like the gamblers of Monte Carlo. And this blind lottery, and you see, again, the blind lottery, just was blinded by economic fire, and now this blind lottery of art history allows some artists to succeed and ruin others. In my opinion, neither the winners nor the losers are worth worrying about. It is a good personal deal for the winner and a bad one for the loser. And even posterity is a real bitch who cheats some, reinstates others like El Greco. And it is also free to change its mind every 50 years. So what he's saying is that there is no art history. He says art history is a blind lottery, and said every 15 years it changes his mind. That means Andy Warhol, which today is a famous artist, could be a very artist as a fringe in 50 years. So what is said here, an artist who was so influential, he says there is no art history, it is only a blind, so the artists are part, it's like gamblers of Monte Carlo. All of us who are doing art here are gamblers like Monte Carlo in a blind lottery. I think we should take serious this statement and not say, oh, Duchamp was wrong. Naturally, all art historians will say he's wrong. We have a very serious method what art history is about. And I would say, I would show you some examples. I could show you millions of examples, but we don't have enough time. I show you some examples about the problem, about artists as a lottery, and I also show you some possible solutions. I mentioned the problem. You see it here. Marcel Duchamp. I think it's a very deep statement, that an artist like Duchamp tells us there is no art history. I know it's not easy to accept, but I ask you, please, be so free and open your mind to this problem. No? There's no art history. No? There was an artist like Prakriti Derevich. He's part of the program of Slot. He took this question seriously. And for example, he made this wonderful piece for the Biennale Venice 1976, a history about two artists. In a time long, long ago, there lived far from the villages and towns two painters. One day the king, who was hunting in the forest nearby, lost his dog. He found him in the garden of one of the painters. When he looked at the painter's work, he decided to bring him to his royal court. The artist's name was Leonardo da Vinci. The other artist's name was forgotten forever in all times. His name is Andelko Hundic. You see now, this is a comment of Prakriti Derevich to this famous problem of art history as a lottery. If the dog of the king would have been on the other garden, then Andelko Hundic would become a very famous painter, and Leonardo da Vinci would be forgotten. But unfortunately, like it is in a lottery, the dog went into the garden of Leonardo, and Leonardo become famous. But see, this is the most famous painting of Leonardo, besides La Gioconda, right? If you make a statistic and ask people, who is Leonardo da Vinci, most of the people would not even say La Gioconda. They would say this man, which was encapsulated in a square and in a circle. But the point is, this drawing is not by Leonardo da Vinci. It is by Vitruv, which was an architect who wrote a book, ten chapters about architecture, 50 years before Christ. So you see, 1,500 years later, and man makes it, it was just an illustration, because at that time, the book of Vitruv was rediscovered, and they made several copies, and said one of the copies was asked, Leonardo was asked to make an illustration to the sentences of Leonardo, of the sentences of Vitruv. And so, precisely what you see here was described in full length by Vitruvius, the Roman architect. And this is just an illustration. And you see what happened. Leonardo became famous for a drawing which was not his origin, which was just an illustration to a text by an architect. So what can happen at the very best in the lottery of art history, you became misunderstood. So what you can do is the best. You make a work when what could be misunderstood. Then you have a chance to survive. This is a chapter by Vitruvius. So about it is about the harmony in the temple, and it's about the harmony of a human, in the human proportion. Okay, here's another game. This is the famous Marcel Duchamp, 1970. And this is his part-time lover, Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Lottringhofen. Morton Schamberg is only the photographer. Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Lottringhofen was a Dadaist, living from Germany, living in New York. She was befriended with Duchamp, and it is very difficult to make a decision who did it first. In fact, nobody could decide it up to now. But you see, it's the same year, it's the same idea, it's a sink. Another thing, the piece of Pablo Picasso, the glass of absinthe, and Mary Oppenheim for breakfast, 1936. In effect, there are some testimonies by Laura. This is a famous piece by Merit Oppenheim because it was bought for the Museum of Modern in New York. Without this piece, for breakfast, Merit Oppenheim would not exist. She never did a piece similar to this. But there's a testimonials by Dora Maar, who was the lover of Picasso at that time, and she wrote in a biography how this piece was done. Merit Oppenheim was sitting with Dora Maar and Picasso together in a coffee, and then she had been discussing his glass of absinthe, this early sculpture. And then Picasso said, you see, it's very easy to make this modern kind of sculpture. He said, Merit, look, we have here coffee in front of us. If you would put it into fur, everybody would say it's a work of art. And so he has ideas. He just went home and did it. Yeah? And she became famous again for an idea which was not hers. Yeah? And in fact, because it was not hers, she never could do it again. Yeah? She did not even understand the logic of the piece. Yeah? But Picasso made many similar pieces. Yeah? Okay. Poltek, you see the sink again. Yeah? Now we have Robert Glober, also with a sink. Yeah? Then you say, yes, it's a sink, like already, like Friedrich Lothringen and like Duchamp, yeah? But it has also feet, yeah? In the sink. Then I say, okay, I also know the source of the feet, yeah? Because this is a famous film by Jean Cocteau, and you see the painting and the wall, and then the hands and coming out from the hole in the wall. Yeah? So the same, the other famous piece by Glober is just a repetition of Surrealist imaginary. Now a next step. This piece by Schwarzkogler, the literature in all art books from Italy to America, this piece is described as an action by Rudolf Schwarzkogler. The famous New York Times and the Newsweek, there was a critic, Hughes was his name, maybe you know him, Hughes, and he made a big book called The Culture of Shock, yeah? And he was attacking modern art, because these pictures have been shown in 1972 at the Documenta in Kassel, and he said, this is the end of the art, this was the title, The End of Art, because here somebody is making self-castration, and as an effect of the self-castration, he was dying, yeah? Yeah. So it was a kind of auto-punishment, auto-castration. And if the body art goes so far that it declares the body of the artist as an artwork and then castrates the body, then this is the end of art. Then there was another artist, Les Levine, who wrote an article against it and defended it. He said, okay, we have this genealogy from the ear of Van Gogh, which was an artwork, and now we have not cutting off the ear, we are now cutting off the penis. So he explained very well in the logic of art, of modern art, what has happened here. And in fact, nothing what people say against it or what people say for it is true. Because what you see here is not Schwarzkogler, what you see here is a model. And so Schwarzkogler hired a model. And this is not even an action. It is a photo. It's a mise-en-scène. It is just done for the photo. Yeah? So what you see here is a penis, but with ink. Yeah? The color is not blood. It is black and white photography. So it is ink. Yeah? It is a simulation of a castration. Yeah? 2 years later, after this... So when Schwarzkogler was alive, we, the Vienna actionists, did not even accept him because it was photography, it was not action. So we said, we are doing actions, real blood, real body, real time, real space, real audience. You do it at home. He did the things at home for a photographer, yeah? And it was not him, so it was not even a performance by the artist. It was just staging for a photograph. And but 7 years later, yeah? 2 years later exactly, he made suicide, yeah? Because he was always depressed, because of his suppressed homosexuality, yeah? And he was also depressed because his wife had an affair with another painter, which is usual in the art world, so he made suicide by purely personal reasons. Yeah? Yeah? But then people combined it, saying, oh, he made suicide, look at his photos. Therefore, in all art historical books, he has his photos, and every page says, this is radical self-castration, radical suicide is radical art. And it is impossible, because you cannot write to all these articles and all these books and say it's wrong. Yeah? Yeah? This is what happens, you see. Art is a little bit like a religion, creating its own mythology, yeah? and its own idea of sacrifice. Yeah? And you cannot change it anymore. No? It's now part of the art history, yeah? That he made suicide by self-castration. In effect, it was a model, not he himself. Okay, when people look at this work of Fontana, nobody would say this guy is pathological, right? So even rich people buy it as a nice picture for their wonderful apartments. But when you do the same, when you say my skin my skin is the screen of a painting, then you make a similar cut like Fontana 8 years later, then people would say this is mad. So Fontana made a lot of money with this, which is okay. But Bruce got into prison. That's strange. Very strange. So the society would say, now we have a divide. This is sane, and this is insane. I would say, if this is insane, okay, but then this is insane too. Because you destroy a painting by cutting it. Then this guy should go into prison too. And therefore, you see, this divide between sanity and insanity is very variable. The next point is, we have seen the urinoir of Duchamp. We've accepted the object of the urinoir. Since it is not functioning, is art. But when suddenly does urinating, then suddenly people say, this is not art. So the object is art, but the activity of urinating is not art. We have the same problem. If we accept an industrial product like an urinoir of Duchamp is an object of art, if we accept it, and I don't say that it was good that we accepted it, but at the very moment when we accept it, Duchamp, then we also have to accept the urination as an activity of art. The same is, we accept Merida da Dista by Manzoni as an object, and we know why we accept it as an object, because objects can be sold. And we cannot sell activities like shitting and pissing. But when we make an object out of it, we can sell it, therefore we accept it, and therefore we make this divide between sanity and insanity. The same you see here. These are pictures by an early book I did together with Hermann Nitsch. On the left side, you see pictures of real murderers. And then on the upper side of this one building, you see a picture of a real murderer, and then an imitation by the artist Nietzsche. The same with the feet. The lower part of the picture is a book of a real murder, and the other part is a picture by an action of Nietzsche. So how you can make the difference between pathological crime and by art? It is not possible. Because these people wanted to say, we want to go into the, with our art, we want to go down in the, if it worked or not is another question. But they said, informal art and Tashist art has to do something with the soul. In the soul we have this unconscious, the subconscious. And here we have all these drives, which in one way can be so strong, these drives that even make a murder. And to make this analogy, it was done by Nietzsche himself. Nietzsche himself did it, to make this analogy with an analogy. So therefore again, the divide, the border between sane and insane is very difficult to draw. Here I did myself some actions together with Wally Expert. And that is also very funny here. You see these pictures. You see me making a speech on this picture. And when we published the piece, it was published as a piece by Wally Expert and Peter Weinold. But then slowly, by feminism, it was difficult to accept that this was a double action by man by woman. Feminists preferred that it be only a work by a woman. And slowly, it turned out to be only a work by Wally Expert. Even when I was on the picture, I was never mentioned that there's a man speaking, even when the text to that action was written by me. So you see again, there was this kind of rewriting process that you make something to a mythological fiction like a religion. Another problem for art history. How is it possible that the famous Amish make similar pieces like modern art 150 or 100 years later? How is it possible? The Amish have no education. They have, look here, Amish Grand in 10. That's a very strange thing. Very difficult to explain. Second half of the 19th century and was written in 1970. This is all about Necker's cube. And the Amish did not know Necker's cube because it was done later. So Necker's cube already was an effect had nothing to do with the Amish guilt. I only give examples to understand the problem. This is a famous photograph by Ernst Mach of a flying bullet. He did it in 87. And you see the bullet in the air, and therefore you have this kind, the air makes a resistance, you have these lines. And these photographs have become very, very famous and shown in many art magazines around 1900. And therefore, when the futurists wanted to express the speed of light, they used precisely these triangles, these cones of Mach. You see it? Yeah? When you're very clever, Let's wait for a moment. This is Chuck Babala, you see. Study of a flying swallow. Huh? Again, Ernst Mach. Huh? But this is 30 years later. Huh? Modern art is always about between 30 and 50 years behind science. This is a great myth of art to be avant-garde. Huh? One of my subjects in my books and research is to show that modern art is a minimum of 30 to 50 years always late behind science. Yeah. And I'll show you something funny here. Even Kenneth Nolan, 1964, Drive, yeah, has still the Ernst Mach, right? And now, when you're very, very clever, you can say what is the next one, what is the next picture. So when you look at your tape recorder, yeah, what do you have there? We say forward and fast forward. Precisely this. So it takes 100 years. So public visual communication takes up scientific codes. It takes 100 years. This is what I mean. When people, we have to think in terms of 100 years, not in 20 or 10 years like the market. Oh, I didn't show it even. This is famous Mach bends. What you see here, when you have a black center and a white surrounding, it is, you see, different of the speeds. The inside can become white or black. Yeah? Your eye decides after certain motion what is light and what is bright and what is dark. And you see that the border is not correct. You understand? You see it? So the border between black and white is very diffuse. Then the same was done with, on the right side with Ernst Mach for contrast and comparison. And precisely, the same was done with Mark Roscoe. You will not find any book about Mark Roscoe, any article, where they mention Mark Roscoe, where they mention Mach. But I did went to his home, looked for his library, and I found Ernst Mach. So you see, how can it be? That it's so evident that people write about metaphysics and whatever they write. But in fact, Roscoe in the beginning was a perceptual study about the border between bright and dark. And he realized, studying Ernst Mach, that this border is changing and you can never really focus it. And like many others at that time, the American artists have read a lot of Ernst Mach. And he was even works by minimal artists, even works by Bruce Nauman and by Chad. Are deeply influenced by the works of Ernst Mach. Yeah? They even make reference to Ernst Mach in their notes. But art historians don't mention it never. Yeah? And how can it be that you have a so-called art history as a science, as a method of science, and they don't know the history of technology, they don't know the history of science. They don't mention Ernst Mach. Yeah? Another case which is even worse. Yeah? Everybody thinks you know what Yves Klein did, right? Everybody thinks we know what Yves Klein did. Yeah? I will show you now that you don't know what Yves Klein did. Even when you had a show in the Centre Pompidou, they did a big show about Yves Klein, and they did not know what they did. And the reason is they did not want why he did his show. Yeah? I show you something. This is Hiroshima and Nagasaki, after the atom bomb. These are the pictures of the victims. And you see people burned down into the earth, right? You see it? Yeah? And it was 1952 that Yves Klein was in Japan because he was into judo. He was a judo fighter. He had a big belt. So he was 1 year he was in Japan, 52, together with Marcelin Pellet and many other French theoreticians. And here he saw these pictures. Yeah? And when he came back, he said, I must do something similar about the horror of this atomic bomb because I have to do something which is burn pictures. This is this famous group fighting with mud, Gutai group. This is a famous Gutai group. And you see precisely where is the origin of these pictures, right? Pardon? Yeah? You see it? Yeah? So this Gutai group have been the first 55 to use the origin of these pictures and placed also people into the mud, like people here in the burned, people in the earth. Since there's another picture, traces of men in Hiroshima, because the shadows of these men on the walls, on the floor, on the staircases. No? And this is precisely where if Lyon has his ideas from. So he was reflecting Hiroshima. Naturally, it's much later. You see, he's even doing this fire. He makes it easy. He even uses fire, like it was the fire of the atomic bomb. The people would say, "Oh, Peter, it's not true. It can't be like this." And I say, "Okay." Then you don't believe it. Then you see here producing a fire. You see the fire? How he does it? Then even has a title. Now you see it. For all these people who are stupid enough not to see it, then I say, "Okay, I show you." 1961, he made a picture called Hiroshima. It's proven. But you did not see this picture as a Santa Bobidou. And there was never the word Hiroshima mentioned, the whole Santa Bobidou. Because I understand, for the people, it's much easier to see the spectacle of naked woman. It's a pleasure for tourists. When tourists go to Santa Bobidou and they see a lot of naked women shuffled around with color, it's a pleasure. But if you would tell them this is about Hiroshima, it would not be a pleasure. And this is truly the effect today. The museum directors, most of the museum directors don't even know. But for the case they know what they're showing, which is rare, then they show, they suppress the information because they want to attract as much audience as possible. So for example, in this exhibition of Yves Klein, you saw even a film about his marriage. This is like these magazines, trash magazines, they are all about parties. But they did not mention in the catalog, not in any show, the word Hiroshima. So it was a true lie to the audience about the truth of the work of Yves Klein. For example, when you go in the Tate Modern from time to time, or the Tate Britain, you have a similar strategy. People show works by Degas, because Degas is the same, you have these little dancers, and they're a little bit erotic, and this is a spectacle of the sexes for the tourist audience. And then even a curator of the Tate Britain will see that the paintings have a strange framing, that some of the arms and some of the legs of the dancers are cut off. Then they say, okay, we must explain it to order what it is, and then they say, this strange position of the dancers comes from Japanism. But in fact, it was just different. Degas was a fanatic, obsessive photographer. And when you make photographs of dancing people, you always cut off something, because you cannot say to the dancer, "Please stay in the middle, I want you for my focus." So dancer is dancing, and you can try to get him, and then you always cut off a leg. So he was painting after photographing. But this would be too complicated for the tourist audience. So the director of the Britain, Britain said, "Let's drop it. Just say it's about Japanese, and we don't care." And this is a style what so see we have people, active people who are ruining the information about art history. I give you another example. As I told you, I could show you many examples. This is one wonderful example. You see here a photograph about, it's called Freud's Faithful Pearl, right? You see it? And this is a so-called, it is about the house, the woman who was taking care of the household of Freud. But the fact what you see in this magazine is a daughter of Freud. It is a daughter. It is not the housewife. And above, you have a book about Freud's office, and it is not Freud's office. Even here, in the book to the left, Peter Brückner, Sigmund Freud's private lecture. It's on the cover, simulating that this would be Freud's library. It is not Freud's library. So can you imagine when you have, when you're writing about Sigmund Freud, when you suppress the real information, that it's clear, this is a clear fact of repression. This is a terminus technicus of Freud. People are not even able to show you a true photograph. So what could be possible solutions? Here's a nice example by Pierre Huc, who was for a short time a good artist. Unfortunately, he has lost his tracks, but for a short time he had good ideas, which is normal, no? That's good enough. You know, from cinema, we call it, when we cut a film, we call it ellipse, that you take out something. For example, when you watch old movies, You see all these people, you see people making a phone call, saying they're leaving the apartment, closing the door, going down the staircases, entering the car, driving the car, entering the restaurant. No? Today it is boring because we have been learned to think visually much smarter, so we don't need it anymore. No? So in this film, the American friend, Wim Wenders, you have the following. One guy, Dennis Hopper, is calling, and then he was talking with his German actor, Bruno Ganz, also calling, then stop. And then we see these two people in a restaurant. This is modern cutting. People can realize when they have found each other, they will meet in a restaurant. And now comes Berhug, and he did the following. 20 years later, he took Bruno Ganz and said, where did you make this phone call in Paris? Where was the restaurant? And then he was taking him and making the way between the place of the phone call and the restaurant. It took him about 20 minutes to make this way. So what was cut out at that time, 68, was cut in again, and he restituted it as he reenacted it. This is what we call today reenactment. He reenacted it again. And what did he do? He showed the telephone scene, then it was a triple projection. He showed the telephone scene, then he showed Bruno Ganz walking in Paris for 20 minutes to the restaurant, and then she stopped, and then you saw on the third screen, you saw the two actors in the restaurant. So what you do here, what is left out, the elliptical cutting comes back reenacted. It is the same when you have one idea, it's good to show it several times. Straw dogs. There was a bank, this is a man who did the bank robbery. Then this was redone by a film, by Martin Scorsese, and said that he did a piece reenacting the film of Martin Scorsese together with the real witness, the man who did the robbery. These are attempts to reconstruct information in the art world which has been repressed by the art representation. The same as a color test. This is an original. Somebody was wearing the red color, then it was reenacted as a film later. People today are reenacting battles. Normal people meet each every year and reenact, so it's even a popular strategy. And then you can do the same, you can reenact reenactments. No? This is a case here. This is a reenactment of a reenactment. No? It gets difficult when people reenact, like Omar Fast, Spielberg's List, because then people don't know anymore what is the film, what is reality. Difficult position. Auditions for Revolution, a similar reenactment. I did an early work about this in Graz. There was a shop, and I suddenly changed the shop precisely like I found it in the photograph, like it was in the 30s, in the Nazi. And I reprinted them, these posters. Don't buy here, this is a Jew. This was then I took the old radios and the old German prizes in the radios, German prizes. But it did not say it is a work of art. I just did it secretly. And then what happened, what was funny, people passed by and think it was real. They didn't do anything because they said, we are in a liberal democracy. If something goes back to Nazism, we don't care. Only when next day it was in the papers, an artwork, suddenly they protested. This is funny. So when you realize it's an artwork, they say, oh, this is not good. But when it was real, it was good. Later, the police came because when I had printed these papers, the printer was clever. The printer said to the police, there's a guy making fascist statements. So he gave information to the police. Then the police came to me and then had a process because they didn't believe that this was art, etc. But finally, I could manage to tell them that this is art. But this is the point. As a real thing, it would not disturb anybody in Austria. This is really crazy. This was a reenactment I did in 1970 about Duchamp. In the 70s, I had the expression reconstruction. I wanted to reconstruct in galleries real places. For example, when you go on a ship, you have three classes of dining rooms. No? And I wanted to say first, second, and third class dining room in a gallery. No? And I did an exhibition, 1988-89. It's called Constructed Art History. I invented 8 artists. This was a painter. This was a revolutionary art. It was a mixture of Rudi Dutschke, and Marcel Duchamp. and send a work for these artists. Justice is just an era of justice. Then I invented somebody who is called Ivanovich. He did furniture sculpture. The Guggenheim is a bar. Sits very well. This is a piece 84, you see. What happened later, 9/11. Sculpture the public space. A prophetic piece. Then Louis Langford, another artist I invented. And then this is a mixture of Arte Povera, Cesare Carlo Capo. So I invented this, I think, and then the media artist, Jan van Buygens. So I had this big museum show, and people really believed me that I was just a curator. And then she came in on my gallery. She was thinking I have a personal show. Then they came in the museum, and then looked around and said, "Peter, very interesting artist, but where is your work?" And then I said, "What you see is all my work, but just fake identities." And some critics did not know that this is me. Some critics said, "Wonderful exhibition, Peter Weibel discovered great six or eight great artists. We are always wondering how he does find them, because we have never heard about them. But they look great and they have a wonderful biography." So you see, in both cases, neither my gallery nor the critics have been able to understand the rules of the game. So what could be another possible use? Here comes the answer again from Duchamp, 57. The creative act is not by the artist alone. The spectator adds his contribution to the creative act. Now comes a difficult act to understand. My opinion is that modern painting is not really modern art. Modern painting is a bridge from 19th century painting to 20th century painting, because it still is into representation. Naturally, you can say, "I don't represent anymore, I make abstract art." But still, even monochrome painting is still painting. What is really 20th century art is the introduction of the object, the real thing, the real body, the real motion, the real spectator. And with this comes, like Duchamp said, the creative act of the spectator. Look here. When you have an object, you know an object is something to use. Each object has not only an exchange value, it has also an use value. That means each object comes with an instruction how to use the object. Sometimes the object is so difficult that you have to read the instruction. Even when you go in a hotel room, it's difficult to find how to get the shower. Many times I cannot do it because I don't find the button to get into the shower. So there's a lack of instruction. And precisely, when Duchamp, this was so clever by him, when he introduced the real object, he did not allow to use the object, right? So it was not, I will show you, who was much more modern. Brancusi was more modern. Brancusi, for example, calls this a stool. This is an abstract sculpture looking like Moore. It has a hole. But Brancusi said, this can be used as a stool, as a chair. It can be a pedestal, it can be a sculpture. So he said, it can be an abstract sculpture, but it can also be an object with a use value. You can sit on it. So he even made banks and made doors. Brancusi became famous, unfortunately, for his abstract sculpture. But in fact, what his most contribution was that he used objects to use. You could sit on it. When you look at his studio, you see precisely he can use it as a pedestal, putting another sculpture on it, or then he says, "No, you can take it down and can sit on it." So in that sense, he was the first, as you know, Duchamp was the dealer of Brancusi. But Brancusi was a little bit old-fashioned because he did the artwork by his own hand. This is very old-fashioned. Duchamp did not touch the artwork, he did not fabricate it. This was much more modern, because it was industrially produced and just normally gestured by the artist. So he looks old-fashioned because he did it, but on the other side is more modern than Duchamp. But anyway, Duchamp said, okay, when we have the object, we have also the instruction how to use. And see, you see here, for the glass, to be looked at with one eye for almost an hour. So you have an instruction how to use this object. In the future, you will have a lot of instruction, what to do with an object. For example, by Mazzone's instruction, place yourself on the magic base and you are an artwork. Later, by Franz Erhard Walter. And he made a book, 68, Franz Erhard Walter, called Objects to Use. So that's very clear. Objects, sculpture, is something to use. So the word user, what we have today in the internet, comes from the art world. User was written already in the titles of books from the art world. Literally, when you look at the book about the internet, nobody cares about Franz Erhard Walter. And the art, and the people who write about, even the art historians, they don't make the connections. These are works by Franz Erhard Walter to use. And now we have, you see, this is Erwin Wurm, I would say 40 years later. And now after 40 years, it is easy. Obey the structure of user state is possible for 1 minute. So now after 40 years, people understand it, and Wurm can become popular and famous. Not Walter. The same with lunch and bike participation DV. Random access, it would take a long time. So we go fast forward. So now we get to another step. You know about the meaning of rewriting, some other solutions. You know Homer's famous work, Ilias, about Troya. And I think this piece already shows you what I mean with rewriting. Because the word Ilias itself comes from the language of the Hittite, because Troya was a smaller city from the Hittite in Asia. And the country where Troya was placed was called Vilusa. And slowly from this word Vilusa, it comes Ilusa and then Ilias. So it was a purely linguistic transformation over several hundred years. And everything what you read in Homer is not true. It is just rewriting stories of other stories. This is a major point. We have today a famous philosophy called deconstruction, which tries to find the origin, the Ursprung. And in fact, I think we should, the Ursprung, the origin is not so important. The important is what happens after the Ursprung. What do we do after the source? How we change the sources? Europe, for example, therefore I start with Troya. It was Aeneas who had to leave Troya with his father on the shoulder. And finally he went to a city which was called Rome later. And this is what we call immigration. If this foundation of Rome is the beginning of Europe, then we see that migration is the beginning of Europe. So Europe is founded by a migrant. It was not an Italian, it was not a European, it was a foreign man who came and founded Europe. So Europe is, the myth of Europe, in fact, is about migration. But speaking in mathematical terms, it's a rewriting problem. So when people speak about migration, ethnic migration, religious migration, whatever, abstract, like we show later, it is just a linguistic term of rewriting. So Homer, people always ask, who can a man do this kind of work? He did not do it. He just rewrote, and probably not himself alone. He had many other stories in front of him, and he was just rewriting them with the help of many others. And the same problem is true with Shakespeare. For example, the famous story of Romeo and Juliet, this famous L'amour fou. It is not invented by Shakespeare. It was not even invented by Strasbourg, by Tristan and Isolde. It comes from a story from 7th century, from Arab story. And when you look, and if I would be an expert in Arab, I would even find other stories before the Arab. So this idea of l'amour fou, that people get crazy about love. And we have these big stories like Rome and Julia. The Arab have the same, but even earlier. And this is what I mean. You cannot find the real origin of this kind of ideas. You only can see how many times it has been transcribed and rewritten. And the first time that a man had the idea to make it a formal problem, and this is the beginning of my real lecture. This is Axel Tue, a Norwegian mathematician. He published in 1914 a wonderful paper. The title is Problems about Changes of Theories of Science After Given Rules. It looks like a little bit like a Deschamps title. And it's also 1914, like Deschamps. Can you understand? Problems about changes, You have a row of signs, yeah? And how do you change them after given rules? Yeah? Tournée, yeah? Yeah? By Duchamp. And he shows you, he says, okay, you see here, you have a series of signs like A and B. Yeah? Yeah? And then you have two rules. Yeah? One rule is, yeah, when you have A, you can change it to BC, to AB, and when you have B, you can change it to A. Yeah? You see it here? Yeah? You have B, then you have A. Yeah? You can always change, this is rule number one. You can change P into A. Yeah? When you have A, you can change it into A and P, yeah? Etc. Et yeah? It's very simple rules. Yeah? In fact, only two rules. And you see it comes out a tree. Yeah? As the tree can become even more complex. Yeah? Yeah? And finally, yeah, this kind of rewriting, he calls it Umschreiberprogramm. He calls it rewriting program. Yeah? Yeah? And here's the example again. You have variables, A and B. You start with A, you change it as a rule from A to AB and from B to A. And now you can make this kind, now with numbers, this chain of signs. You see it? You understand it intuitively. No? A can become AB. B can become A. So you have always a tree, no? Because you make A, you have AB, so you take B can become A, and A can become AB, so you make a tree. And then Aristide Lindemeyer, 50 years later, he used this mathematical formula, like Fibonacci numbers, he used it to make a real tree. Can you imagine? What you see here on the left, a fractal plant. This fractal plant, which looks like nature plant, is nothing else than a rewriting problem. It's nothing just a mathematical algorithm. It's a very simple mathematical algorithm. Yeah? And the algorithm is just like this one. A to B, B to AB. Yeah? So we have here now found for the first time, we have other, the golden section is a rewriting rule. Or the Fibonacci numbers is a rewriting rule. And today we have a lot of much more complicated rewriting rules. So the first time we have something, we have a rewriting rule which can make a drawing of nature. Yeah? With these rewriting rules we can make drawings of clouds, of water, of plants, of everything. Yeah? So we see that it is true. The mathematical language is the true language of nature. Yeah? Because otherwise we could not imitate it as perfectly. And now, what is also important, the famous linguist Noam Chomsky, when he wrote his famous transformative grammar, mathematical models of natural language, he used 2A2. Therefore, it is called semi-2A, half-2A systems. So the first mathematical language, invented by Chomsky, was called semi-2 systems. And later, 1960, some of his pupils, Nack and Bauer, they said, let's make it more mathematical, and they called it ALGOL. It's called algorithmic language. And all programming languages what we have today, all programming languages are coming from ALGOL. They come from these two systems. Therefore, these modern computer languages are created by simply rewriting rules, and they can image, they can make all calculations of the world and can represent all images of the world. So. Then another help to understand what is going on in the world, and I give you some examples, which are very astonishing. No? Why do you think France has the name of France? No? La France. No? It's a strange name, no? Why is it strange? I already told it. It is strange because the Franken, the German, only have ruled over France 300 years. In fact, the true name of France would be Gauloise or La Galle, because French people are Gallic people, like Obelix and Asterix. What is the name? Asterix and Obelix? So you know these comics, Asterix and Obelix. And in fact, these Asterix and Obelix are so famous and so popular because they're the only one who still has a Gallia, because the others are French people. So there was a writer in the 16th century. A moment. His name was Babli. There's this famous Bonnot de Condillac, a famous philosopher Condillac, and he had a brother. His brother was Bonnot de Babli. He was a historian and a philosopher. Huh? And he wrote 4 volumes, Observations on the History of France, Observations sur l'Histoire de France, 1765. And he was complaining already at that time that the French people have the wrong name. Because the Franken are German. Yeah? Why should they call us, like in Germany, Frankreich, yeah? The Royaume of the France, yeah? of the Germans? No? We should call us, he said, La Gaule, La Gaulas. But therefore, you see, the France have only 2 things left, which is La Gaulas, the cigarette, yeah? And Abelix and Osterix. Very poor nation. Yeah? And because of this complex, they always are saying, we are the grand exception. Yeah? Afterwards, because of this complex, they try to invent themselves bigger as they are. So in fact, what we can say, French has been rewritten and overruled. This is now the critical point. When you're not able to rewrite yourself, you'll be rewritten by somebody else. This is it. What we see here from these lectures is, instead of evolution, we should speak about rewriting programs. Because rewriting programs is not the struggle of the evil, not the struggle of the better. Rewriting rules are more civil, civilized than the Darwinian struggle and survival of the fittest. And many nations don't understand this. And I give you some very wonderful different examples. For example, everybody knows, thinks to know, what is the 9th symphony of Beethoven, right? 9th symphony of Beethoven is very famous, very used very often. When Beethoven wrote it, he was thinking of the French Revolution. It was premiered 1824. So it was written as an echo of the French Revolution, 1824. So it was for Egalité, Fraternité, etc. But now comes the point, people didn't care. The 9th symphony was a major symphony of the German fascists. It is even the national anthem of the apartheid regime of Rhodesia. Rhodesia, an apartheid regime, didn't care about Beethoven. She said, this is a famous popular song, we just use it. And today it is a hymn of Europe. You see, this is rewriting. And people don't even know. Beethoven thinks it's about the French Revolution. The German Nazi thinks this is our great Beethoven. The Rhodesia thinks, oh, this is a great German song, so we have to use it. We are also fascists. And then Europe country forgets everything and uses it again. Or, for example, when you know what is Marzipan? Yeah. The sweet things. So Marzipan, in fact, comes from an Arabic word called Maftaban. It was the Arabic word for sitting king. And about 1000 in Byzance, you had a coin. On this coin was Jesus Christ sitting on a king's throne. And the Arabic word for this was Mataban. But actually, when you have a coin, someday it will be used as for exchange, as exchange money, and someday it was 200 years later, that in Venice, they used it still. It was the Doge Enrico Dandolo, and they had an institution where to print coins. And this is now the migration of a word. First, it was this print, this coin, but when you have an institution who prints coins, then people call the institution. They called it Mataban. So it was not the coin anymore, it was the institution to print coins, right? This is this kind of migration of the meaning of the word. And then actually when you have a printing, then suddenly it becomes a tax institution. When everything comes to Venice, you have to have a stamp and say, this is now through tax. And this again was called Mataban. And then finally the boxes became smaller and smaller. And in language we have something which is called contingency. For example, after this lecture, some people will say, let's go drink a glass. We don't drink the glass, because then we'll have blood and mouth. We drink the water contingent to the glass, right? what is next to it. This is a very famous strategy of language, to make always a shift and not talk about the content which is topologically close to it. No? We don't drink the glass, we drink the water in the glass. And therefore, people would say, okay, if this is a small box, we don't call the box Marzipan anymore, we call what is inside, like the water is a glass, we call it Marzipan. So it took about 700 years that Jesus Christ turned into sweet Marzipan. And this happens all the time. This happens not only to words, it happens to culture. All culture, all politics is just rewriting. I give you the most famous example. What is a typical, there's one word with three letters, the most typical Spanish word is called ole, right?
Ole.
Ole, yeah? And this, in fact, means Allah. So the Spanish, you see, have always been overruled, like the French, because 800 years was the Arab have been in Spain, and then 1492, the Arab lost everything and they have been had to leave Spain, and now we have about 700 years Catholic Spain. Even 700 years of Catholic Spain was not enough. Today they all say, every day they say Allah. They call it Ole, but in fact it means Allah. Now, after 700 years, the rewriting is so strong that they use this expression naturally without knowing it. This is always the best. So what I wanted to show you is that the rewriting is a process which is not only a linguistic process, it is a cultural, it's a cultural rule. And this is, in fact, precisely what culture is about. Conservative people always understand like culture as it is. For example, Europeans today think, this is now Europe as we want it. When you look back at Europe, it was always rewritten, it was always changed. And why should we stop it now? Europe in 100 years will look differently, very differently than it looks today. And this is precisely the point. Rewriting is the heart of the matter. And therefore, when we want that art system is a living system, we have to be able not to canonize it, we have to be able to rewrite it, to make known people forgotten and to make forgotten people known. This is a process of culture. I show you two other important linguistic ideas. You know the Pavlov reflex, which says, if a dog gets some food and hears a bell, the dog is intelligent enough to be a sign processing animal, because a dog who hears a bell and knows now comes food must be able to make to understand it. Otherwise, he would not be able to. So he has a sign. He's a sign processing animal. Okay. So then, and when you now comes the point when you hear the ring of the bell, then this is what we call an index, because it is a sign which comes from the object physically. When you hear a car, so you know it comes from the car. It's not a symbol, it's an index. When you see a fire, then you know it is, no, when you see a cloud, then you know it comes from a real fire. So people always say, there's a cloud, there must be fire. Otherwise, it's not possible. This is what we call an index. So you hear the bell, but now you see the dog is even more intelligent. He knows it's not the bell. Because if it would be the bell, he would not care. He knows the sound of the bell means food. So the dog is even a symbol processing animal. He understands that this is a symbol, this is a great thing. The dog is much more intelligent than we think. So because in fact, he realizes the ring of the bell means food. And if this is the case, then we can do the following. We can show the dog a picture of Elvis Presley and give him food. Then he will learn, anytime when you show him a picture of Elvis Presley, he knows it means food. Next time you can show him a formula, you can show him number 3. And the dog will know, number 3, this means food. So he said, you see, what we learn, even a dog can learn to use a symbol. But now comes the point. In contemporary society, the symbol can be anything. Like I showed before, the symbol must not be the ring of the bell, or at number 3, the symbol can be anything. That means if we do not give a value to the symbol, we self, somebody else will do it. The best expression would be to explain it to you by toxicology. Yeah? When people complain about drugs, etc., intoxication, then I have only one formula. Yeah? The injection of the drug is always into emptiness. Right? You understand? So when you inject drugs, it's only possible because there's an emptiness inside this person. Yeah? If you have a life without holes, then you don't need drugs. Yeah? And it's the same. If you don't give value, in a mathematical sense, to a symbol, then somebody else will do it for you. Yeah? And actually, if somebody else will do it for you, it's not as good as you do it yourself. Yeah? And this is what we are living today. We are living in a kind of symbolic culture, which has, like Baudrillard called it, these floating signifiers, these floating values. Yeah? And now comes the salvation, yeah? Which comes from Roman Jakobson. Roman Jakobson made a series of languages, it's called binary opposition. Yeah? Binary opposition means when you say white, you always think of black. Yeah? Yeah? When you say low, you always have to think of high. Yeah? There's always this binary opposition. And he proved it in a vocal cube. Yeah? It's too complicated. You see, in the front, in the back, high, low, rounded, non-rounded. So he proved it on the level of morphology and phonology. Yeah? That all languages built on binary opposition. Therefore, we have also a 0 and 1, yeah? This binary code. Yeah? So this is a final proof. Yeah? I said 0 and 1, yeah? Two values only as a binary code can describe the world completely. And when you know this, yeah, you can very easily decipher our world. Look at this advertising. Get a part-time job with a company car. Yeah? It wants to seduce you to go to the army. Yeah? And that's very interesting. Yeah? Because the car normally is individual mobility. No? People buy a car because to be mobile, individual, not with the train and not with the bus, etc. No? Yeah? And military is just the opposite. It's military is about collective. No? Yeah? And now what they do is precisely this. They say, oh no, this is not a Panzer, what you see here. Yeah? 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 This is a car. Yeah? So what they're doing is just binary opposition. Yeah? What is collective becomes individual. Yeah? And this is what most strategy today people do. Yeah? They don't say this is a war operation. They say it's a peace operation. Yeah? Germans, for example, said when they went into Afghanistan, no, this is not about war. Yeah? This is a peace operation. Yeah? So when NATO was bombarding Yugoslavia, yeah, it was also a peace operation, for sure. Yeah? And what is strange, people forget, that in 1984, this famous novel of Orwell, all this is already written. Yeah? Already in Orwell, he said, this is not a ministry of war, this is a ministry of peace. Yeah? And when the future make war operation, you must call it peace operation. It's all written down in 1984 of Orwell. No? And this is precisely why he could do it. Yeah? Coming, Orwell, he had this experience of totalitarian regimes. He was in Spain, he was part of the Spanish Civil War. Yeah? So he learned to decipher the language as a binary opposition like it is done here. Mm? Okay? So one's last. Thank you. Please rewrite me. Rewrite this lecture.